This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past and present.
This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series.
Alan C. Jones is an award-winning writer from California. He has lived and taught in Spain, Mexico, Korea, China, and presently serves as an associate professor of literature in Norway. He has an MFA in poetry, a PhD in English, and his work appears widely online and in print. Alan's novel, Her Death Was Also Water, was published by Midnight Sun Publishing in November 2022. Welcome, Alan, to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Well, this podcast is called The First Time, and that's because we like to start at the very beginning. Have you always been a writer?
No, I was. I wanted to be a professional basketball player, in fact.
Oh, didn't we all?
Yes. And I worked very hard on that. I was a very organized child, and I first was introduced to basketball when I was about maybe 10 years old. And for maybe 9 years, I practiced every day. I didn't have any coaches in the beginning. I went to the library and got a book on basketball because I had no ideas about basketball. I looked up all these drills. I studied it. I went to the park every day for 2 hours. I was a strange kid, and I decided I'm going to be professional. That's what I'm going to do. And I kept playing until I was about 19, and I got to the college level, and I realized that I wasn't a very big human, and basketball takes very big humans. So I ended up getting injured in college my second year. Relatively badly, not life ending or whatever, but enough where I kind of had to quit. And it was super sad. I was super sad.
Yeah.
And then suddenly my life opened up because I'd spent all my time playing basketball. I ended up going to Spain to study, and I realized I met this poet. I started playing guitar. I started writing. And that's kind of when the art side of my life blossomed. And I realized how much more interesting it is. I love basketball, but it's pretty simple in terms of, the intellect and, broadening your horizons. It's beautiful. It's like dance. So that was sort of the switch. And then I guess when I was 21, I graduated from college, and I was so obsessed with writing. It was like taking over my life. I'm kind of an obsessive person.
It is sounding like that.
Yeah. I didn't like it. I was like, I felt bad about my job and stuff. So I decided not to write for 1 year, just straight. So I didn't let myself write at all for 1 year. And I said, if I still want to write after this, and obviously it's not just some childish thing, maybe I was thinking of basketball. After a year, I still wanted to write. So then I got back to it, and I've kind of been doing it ever since, 27 years, I guess.
I love that. And poetry has been a feature, or has it been poetry, short form, fiction, long fiction?
Yeah,
what kinds of things?
Once again, my obsessive personality, I only let myself write and read poetry for about over a decade. Because I wanted to, like basketball, I wanted to train myself. And I thought you need to train by, you look at the videos, you read the books, like basketball. So I ended up, one thing is I thought that if I traveled the world, I think I had some mistaken ideas about Hemingway, never having studied Hemingway and realizing that, he learned to write from all the greats as opposed to just running around the world. So I ended up in my 20s, just running around the world, learning foreign languages, studying. I became licensed in the tea ceremony in Korea. I learned martial arts, and I thought that would somehow make me a good writer. And at 29, I realized that, in fact, I should probably, go learn from somebody. And a friend of mine who was a poet who had studied with Gary Snyder, who, I don't know if you know Gary Snyder, but, a huge name in American poetry. He said, Alan, you can go to, because I had no money, you can go to grad school for free. Like they'll give you money and you can just teach some classes. So I immediately canceled all plans. I had a job in Thailand. I canceled that. And I went online and Googled how to go to grad school. And so I got an MFA in poetry. I assumed I'd get famous in like a year or two, because that's what I thought. You write a book, you get famous, obviously. That didn't work out. So I just kept chugging along. And at a certain point, I switched. I was always a kind of a closet fiction writer, and I switched over. But really, like for a decade, I still love poetry. I find I can't write it anymore. When I try to write it, it's just, I still love it and I still appreciate it. And I still think of it as this amazing art, but I really have a hard time writing it. which is unfortunate because next year my debut poetry book comes out. And that's not a good thing when you can no longer actually understand poetry. So don't tell anybody that. I hope this isn't being recorded.
Yeah, that's right. We'll keep it on the down low. We are going to talk a bit about your debut novel, actually, which is called Her Death Was Also Water. It's just come out this month. It's a pretty wild ride. Yeah. How do you describe it?
Well, I have this little pitch, you know, it's weird because I spent 6 years writing it. And I started writing, and remind me of your question, because I'll just tell this little thing. I started writing it kind of as a game slash escape. I had moved to Norway by myself. It's not the kind of country you want to go to by yourself and live exactly, just in terms of your ability to enter into the culture. You know, I've lived in places that, even like Korea, where it's very difficult, but it's possible. Norway's more difficult than that. Mm. And I didn't realize that, but I was sort of there, and I started writing as an escape. Each night I would sit down and write 4 pages, and I would just follow a character. And I picked these characters and I sort of saw what they did, as if, you know, not a very good way to organize and outline a novel. So I ended up with this very wild thing. And then over the years, I worked on it and sort of honed it. And then what was your question? This was going to lead to your answer.
Well, I'm interested in this too, this process of honing. But my original question was, how do you describe the book?
So if you want, like, and so I've come to Australia, I've spent a month on this book tour, and I've learned a lot about, like, book selling, I guess, which I didn't know. And I realized it's all true. Like, you have to condense your very complex novel into a couple sentences. So basically my couple sentences, if that's what you're looking for, like my little pitch that I've honed, is that there is a flood, and this flood doesn't stop. So we have 7 characters in a small town in America who are very, very different kinds of people. And each of them has lost someone that they dearly love. And they're not all particularly good people, but they think they're good people. And we see through their perspectives. And so we're looking through their eyes at their lives and how they're dealing with loss. And then this flood puts them on a motorboat together, and they're stuck there. And this sort of intensifies their situation and them dealing with loss. And as the book goes along, this flood reaches proportions that no longer make sense. And in some ways, that was meant to mirror the way that personal loss doesn't make sense emotionally. If you lose somebody, if they die, you can say, you know, my sister died, my father died. But emotionally, that doesn't really mean anything. So as the book progresses, as you know, the book progresses, we actually end up zeroing on one of the characters, Charlotte, who's the youngest character on the boat, and not physically the strongest, but she discovers in the book that she's the emotionally the strongest character. And it's sort of the story of her discovering that. And that's the sort of the centerpiece of the novel. And it moves from realism to magical realism. The idea there being that they discover this place. I won't give too much away, but they discover this place where, and they meet people that have to do with who they are and what they've lost. And it's not really clear where they are or who they're meeting. And the idea is that this is sort of exploring their loss, how they're dealing with it. And the fact that it's never quite explicable. And this is why we have heaven, why we have angels, because loss doesn't really make sense to us emotionally. So that's sort of that was a sort of elongated pitch, I guess, for the book. One thing that I was interested in is people ask me sometimes, why is this flood sort of not explained? And it's, you know, people can say, you know, it's climate fiction, you know, we have these disasters. But for me, it kind of comes from Katrina. My mom's from New Orleans, and I live down there in Louisiana. And our family was in Katrina, this hurricane that took place, like, I guess, like almost 20 years ago now. But it was a hurricane that came and left. Everyone went outside afterwards. It was sunny. And then the water started to rise, and it was inexplicable, and it rose, and people got into the second floor of their houses. The water rose. They got into their attics. The water rose, and many people drowned in their attics because the water just would not stop rising, and it made no sense. And so for me, being inside a disaster, if you're experiencing it, can make no sense. Later, of course, we know there's logic to it. We can explain it. But when you're there, for me, that's the same way loss works. In loss, when it's happening to you, you can't just explain it. Like, oh, yeah, okay, the levees broke. My sister died. That doesn't really work. It's something it's harder to come to. So I used that in my book. I used environmental disaster to mirror personal loss and explore that. That's a long pitch. That's not the pitch, but that's what I like to say about the book.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I think it's this really interesting contrast in the book element, or contrasting elements in the book. You have this kind of climate fiction feel through the flooding. There's obviously a biblical element that we associate with flooding, but kind of also this high sea adventure. Yeah. You know, there's different ways that you can look at the exact same thing.
And I did it. Go ahead. Just because you said biblical, I did try to turn that down some and push it into the character perspectives. One thing I wanted to do is to put these interpretations into the characters, so there's no author saying, here's what really happened, that we only get it through, you know, these different characters. But anyway.
A question on craft. A lot of this book, it's raining, and then it's flooding, and then it's set on a small boat that's surrounded by water. There's this element of constraint to setting, like it's escalating, but it's also there's an element of continuity to it. Was that challenging? And how do you create a sense of variety when there's a lot of sameness in the background?
Yes, great question. I was teaching a theater class because that's what they gave me to teach, and I had to teach to pay my bills, and I knew nothing about theater, and so I had to figure out theater. And the theater director at my school came by, and I was having my students do skits, you know, do little scenes they'd written, and one scene was in a car. And she was from a different culture. She was sort of edgy, and she really just shot them down. And I had to like kind of protect my students from her. But she basically said, you can't do a scene in a car because you can't go anywhere. You can't move. It totally constrains these actors. Do not do a, like, you may not do a scene in a car. And years later, I've written this book about people in a boat.
Yeah.
You do not write a book about a boat because where can they go? What can they do? All they can do is sit there and talk. So just in case there's listeners out there who are going to read it, they don't just sit there and talk. That is one aspect. But what I ended up doing was I realized that they had to arrive places. So they had to get places. Even though it's a world of mostly water, as they move along, they do end up in different locations, passing things, exploring underwater things. And, you know, I don't want to give it away. But I sort of had to do that in some ways in terms of craft, because you can write, of course, you can write a play of three people in a room, but it's really hard. And it works better as a play than as a novel, perhaps. So in the end, I don't want to give it away. Originally, they didn't arrive. Originally, they see the place they're going to, and the book ended. And then I realized, no, they've got to get there. They need to get there and find what's actually there. It needs to become real.
It's a bit of a sleight of hand, though, at the same time, isn't it?
Or what do you mean?
The arrival or non-arrival. Like, does this place really exist?
Yeah, because I didn't want them. I wanted a book that left us thinking deeply about how different people experience something that's inexplicable.
Mm. I want to talk about, I know Charlotte is the main character of the book, but there is a character that jumps off the page, maybe not always in the best of ways, and that's Deacon.
All right.
Who is kind of horrendous, but compelling at the same time. He's someone who portrays masculinity in a particular way, I think. What does this character, Deacon, offer as a criticism of masculinity, and how conscious was the process of constructing him?
Yeah, remind me, that's a great two-part question, because I'm going to get lost in my sort of memories of this. So I didn't set out to write a book about masculinity, but it is something I've thought a lot about in my life, being someone who doesn't, you know, I'm sort of a white middle-aged guy, I guess. Played sports or whatever. I lived in a world of sports for a long time, but I never felt like I fit in exactly. And I experienced sort of this hyper-masculinity that comes along with that world. And so it's something I sort of thought about. I was raised, it's a long story, but I was raised in sort of a feminist community that was run by a woman, where people were treated as not boys and girls, but just sort of people. That was sort of my training as a kid. And then when I was 10 years old, when I learned about basketball, I also went to public school for the first time and realized that in the world, gender was very divided. It was mm-hmm. traditional compared to the way I was raised. So that was sort of shocking to me. And so over the years, I've just thought about that, and it sort of seeped into me. And in this book, I ended up kind of accidentally with the four of the male characters, really exploring four very different ways of trying to inhabit masculinity. And Deacon is the one who's the most sort of absurd and obvious, and also the one that in some ways is me working through two real people that I grew up with, that I may have shared a bunk bed with. Americans won't hear this podcast, but that I was sort of afraid of, but also was fond of, because they were like family to me, because they live with us. And so it's in some ways I was exploring, you know, what about their lives made sense. And one thing was, like, Deacon in this book, he loves rules. And I like rules. I was the kind of kid, I was the good kid. I wanted rules. I wanted to be safe. I wanted to know what was going on. And here's someone who takes this very, very good value for some people. I mean, some people hate rules, but he's not a bad value. And then the way it works out in his life is terrifying, because he has to have power through those rules. And so with a lot of these characters, I'm trying to do that, where I'm saying these root values aren't terrible, but the way they're playing out, it really is. And partly living in the United States in the South, which is a very different political landscape than where I'm from, I learned that the people I met there, I disagree with them a lot. Like, you know, I'm not a supporter of Trump, for example, but their root values, when you got down to them, you know, they made sense. It was the way they were playing out. And so I was trying to explore that and sort of say, here's someone who's obvious. I mean, Deacon's the most absurdly just, not absurdly, but he's the most, like, you know, unsavory, I guess, or the bad guy. But I was also trying to push towards saying, well, in his world, this is how he's trying to make sense of it, even though in the end, you know, we can't approve of it. But we can understand to some extent those values and how they can go wrong.
Alongside Deakin, or really the only person on the boat in the book that likes Deakin or is perhaps sympathetic to Deakin, is Carol, I think. And a defining characteristic of her is that she is a Trump supporter. So we have this kind of coupling of these two people. You've talked a little bit about life in the South. Why do you see these characters as going together? How do they see each other?
Well, I do think there's something going on. You know, this book is not like, I don't want to emphasize too much, like it's a political commentary. In an early draft, I wrote it during, like after Trump had gotten elected, and I think it had a lot of that stuff in it. And basically what I did was I reduced that down to the Carol character. And I never mentioned his name. I never say Voldemort's name. But I do have her. And one thing that's interesting to me is how women could support Trump. In America, I'm trying to make sense of that and think, you know, what is it here that's making sense to someone who doesn't fit the traditional notion of a conservative? What is it? And so I was trying to explore that with her, with how would it make sense to someone who actually I have a soft spot for. So Carol, she's a strong character. I mean, she's a heroic character in many ways. But if we met her, perhaps we might not agree with her. And I want to say what's gone on in her life where she's doing things that are, she's a very strong woman. She's using the things that she has to become powerful. We may not agree with what she's doing, but she's using those things. And one is to idolize someone who has gained power, has gained political power. Mm. And she wants to become a politician. She wants to become successful, which I'm like, wow, that's amazing. That's a lot of energy. But once again, we might see that as perhaps going, those values going the wrong direction. But yeah, why did I pair those two? There is also the you know, biology and sex and that runs through the book and how that factors into these situations. You're on a small boat. You have people who feel different ways about sex and about the body. And that's something that they're navigating in different ways. And so I did have that one be one of my themes. You know, Mo has a particular relationship with the body and sex. Carol has, you know, what we might consider, I'm sort of challenging the reader, we might consider a more masculinized version of this, but I think that's pretty much not real. It's kind of a stereotype about how sex and the body works. So I ended up pairing them. Although I feel like Trent, the little brother, also looks up to Deakin, of course, but he's sort of trapped, I guess. Yeah.
I think it's also important to point out that there is a lot of humor in this book. And I really think that Deakin and Carol are the funniest characters or the most satirical. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun, especially early on. So originally, when I first was going to write the book, because I'm a literature professor, I love reading James Joyce, even though I do find him boring, but I love studying him. But I did want to write a boring book. I wanted to write a book that really grabbed people and the pages turned while being character driven. And so I said to myself, I want to have a bad guy. Like the quote, in quotes, the bad guy. I'm like, I'm just gonna have someone who's just bad, everyone hates them, and then I'm gonna kill him, and the book's gonna be great. But then I started writing from Deakin's perspective, and I started kind of having fun because I was in power. I was now getting to, like, you know, see in his mind and kind of make fun of him some, but also through things that he would actually support, be like, yeah, that's right, I agree with that, and making him a little bit, you know, simpler perhaps than he was. And so I ended up having a lot of fun with the character. I think that comes out in the humor, especially early on. Alexia is also another one who I really relate to and had some fun with in terms of her wish to be a writer and what happens with that, which speaks to me a lot.
Yeah, it's true. You can feel the fun, particularly, I think, in the writing of Deakin, because there's also, I like thinking about how the humor works. I think with Deakin, it is that unpacking. If you have a character that will have a fairly extreme point of view, it's unpacking the logic that can get you from a value or a seemingly, you know, something sort of innocuous to something very extreme, how the steps that take you from one to the other.
Yeah. Yeah. And with that character, he really is sort of, I was trying to trace him from a place where he's just sort of, you know, a little bit clueless, but really driven, you know, has a really powerful drive. And then slowly, step by step, he gets to a place where he doesn't believe that what he's doing in the end, I don't want to give it away, but he even interprets that as something almost beautiful. And we definitely don't, you know, because it's gone so far. He has a very powerful view of the world, which is not, it's less and less connected to reality. Even though in the book, he's the only person who doesn't experience the sort of non-real element. So in some ways, he's the most pragmatic. He saves the people. He's the one who's the pragmatic viewpoint. But in the end, that's reversed. And we sort of see that happen through what he does.
I'd like to talk about your other work as well. Alan, we've already mentioned you've got a background in poetry, but you appear to have a pretty broad body of work in general. We have a lot of listeners to this show that are writers, and we'll put some links to your website in our show notes. As writers, I think we tend to circle around the same themes a lot. We have these things that we're very interested in. What, as a writer, preoccupies you?
Well, it's changed. Maybe it hasn't, actually, now that I say that. But in the beginning, in this book of poems that's coming out next year, was really based on, I grew up in what's called an intentional community. So it's a group of people who get together, not for religious reasons, to try to develop a utopian group, you know, community to change the world. And so this group had their own school, they had their own system of knowledge. And it wasn't apart from society. It was kind of in the local towns and, you know, where I lived. But growing up there was a very unique experience. Mm. Of course, I didn't know that. I had like 300 aunts and uncles. I had all these people living with me. I mean, a lot of the characters in this book, you know, Charlotte, for example, there's people in this book who are not those people, definitely, if anyone's listening who knows those people, but it was influenced by those people. You know, I really for a long time wrote about that. I wrote about growing up and I wrote poems about that. And, you know, I think when you're a young writer, I think I was 18 or whatever, you know, what else can you write about? You're pretty young. Mm. I wrote about that. And for a long time, I was very interested in trying to work out. And then that community kind of went, there's a darkness that came in that community near the end. And I was kind of grown up by then, but my parents experienced it very, very much. And they almost lost everything they had, and they had to end up breaking apart from this community. And it was a pretty negative experience for them. And so that really affected my view of like my writing and this beautiful book of poems about this wonderful place. And I thought to myself, oh, there was this, you know, this side that was not so nice to it. And so that started to factor in. But then there was a break when I switched to fiction. I really moved away from that. And I felt like fiction was a way to break out and make things up and escape this sort of obsession with this childhood that I had. At this point, even with fiction, it seems like these characters that I've known seep back into my writing. So even as I try to shed them, they seep back in. So what, at this point, I have moved to Norway. And so now what kind of interests me, now that I finished this novel, the book of poems are done, and I'm sort of moving forward, the next project is a book of short stories that I'm finishing. And it is really, I'm using humor, I'm using Nordic noir, like this sort of dark comic northern, you know, mermaids and talking whales and you know, just sort of this very, very, it's going to be a very strange book, and I'm going to really like it. And because it's short stories, I think there's more room for humor to carry a story. In a novel, you have to have that plot, you know, but you have to have a plot in a short story, but you have a lot more room for the voice to really drive it. So at this point, I'm really moving towards real fiction, like stuff that really is not people I know dressed up. And I'm really enjoying that. It's really kind of freeing. Like I'm in Australia, but I was in Fremantle at this festival, and I saw this bird. I think it's one of those little black birds you guys have. They make funny noises.
Magpie.
And I swear it was meowing.
Mean birds, though.
Are they mean? They're weird.
Oh my God! If you've been swooped by magpies.
It was meowing. Like, I was making this meow, and I thought, what if you woke up as a bird and you had a meow? And to a bird, that's actually a roar, because cats are very, very scary. What would your partner think? You know, like, are you making fun of them? What's happening? And so what I'm sort of doing now with my stories is looking at these issues like, you know, domestic life and things like that. And still looking at gender. I am pretty interested in gender, but through this sort of more absurd than Deacon, you know, more further, more humor, pushing really in that direction and letting myself run free with that sort of thing. So
that's exciting.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to ask, just to transition slightly, one of the things on your website that you talk through is metaphor mapping. What is metaphor mapping?
Yeah. I haven't looked at it recently, but I developed this program with some programming students at my old university, and I'm still working on it. I need to get, you know, programmers again. It's hard to do this. But I'm very interested in the way that very complex metaphors can work. And this is kind of more of my academic work. But the novel itself, having seven characters in a book and trying to interweave all of the parts, is to me is kind of building a machine of a metaphorical machine that can be very, very complex and fascinating. And so in my PhD, I was looking at ways to use three-dimensional immersive mapping, like virtual reality is what we call it now. Back then it was sort of simulated, to try to have a reader experience these very complex connections in a text by walking through them and playing with them, like physically. So this is very hard to do. It's getting easier, I guess, with virtual reality. But it's the idea that and usually it's poetry. So it came from Dylan Thomas and Virginia Woolf, where you have these texts that don't really make that much sense. You know, they're not page turners. And you're like, what on earth is this doing? And if you start to map all these connections, you start to see this very, very complex but fascinating map of what a text is doing. And it becomes beautiful and visual. There's actually a book published just of the visual maps that people have made of texts, just because they're pretty.
And so some of that looks like is, so you would look at the relationship between the word water and flood and, or flow. Yeah,
exactly.
And look for clusters. Is that kind of?
Yeah, basically that's what I was doing mostly. And people often, you know, it's an old concordance is like one of the oldest ways of looking at literature, you know, where you just take where, how many times does Dylan Thomas write the word water? Where is the word water in his text? And I used to do it with books, which I still actually have the one for Dylan Thomas. I love it. It's a big leather book. But then saying, okay, books are, I love books. They're linear though. Is there a way we can collapse this information using three dimensions? And it turns out it's very, very hard actually. Books are very, very efficient. Mm-hmm. They're not going to die. You don't need to worry about books dying. But yeah, just trying to look at relationship between words. And in my other, you know, one of the other things I do, I didn't mention, is experimental poetry. At this point, I do write poetry, but the only poetry I write is experimental, and it's only game-based. So I design games, I play them, and then they produce texts. So it's kind of, it comes from my studies of surrealism. And I do this with my students also. This is where my teaching hat is. I teach surrealist games, Oulipo games, and then conceptual games. It's a class in the 20th century in experimental writing. And to those will produce. So I produced, my favorite at this point is I produced from studying Norwegian every morning and watching the Norwegian news and translating it and then making a game out of it. I produced a series of couplets that are a newspaper that talk about the world, but in a sort of funny, ridiculous sometimes, but also political, you know, Putin's in there. But it's meant to be the kind of thing I showed my family and they were like, ooh, I like this one. It's like, they're funny, but they're pointed. So it's doing political commentary, you know, through this funny kind of haiku method that's based on translation. And really I was just trying to learn Norwegian and I got bored and I needed a game because I get bored.
So what is the game factor? What would the game bit look like?
So yeah, the game is, I mean, it's more like a puzzle. I like the word game because it sells, but it's more like a puzzle. But basically what I would do is I would take a page full of lines from the news. I would translate them. I would reorganize the words until I made something happen. And I didn't know what I was trying to do. I was just like, I don't know what I'm trying to do, but something has to happen. And I would discover as I did that things would happen. And sometimes it'd be funny, sometimes it'd be political, sometimes it'd be offensive. And then I had to gauge, what can I do? What can I keep? And so it was basically this word game without a real, it's like a sandbox word game. And this is what I'm trying to develop, is a way with students, like I work with high school students and university students, how can you develop a student mind to think of writing as a sandbox as opposed to a linear thing? Because of course the product's going to be linear, but what if you say, okay, here's your words, play with them, see what you can do. You don't know what you can do, see what happens. And that's what the surrealist games do. The surrealist games are like two people each writing a sentence or a word and then sticking them together randomly, and all of a sudden you go, this is the best writing I've seen. And yesterday in Melbourne at the independent publishers conference, someone talked about AI writing, and some of the weird sentences that these computers come up with that are terrible are also really funny.
Yeah. So, well, this nice marriage of randomness and artful selection.
I suppose. Exactly. And that's perfectly put. Those two points. Yeah. Randomness. And then someone who's a human saying, what is artful? What do I want to use? And that poem is actually, there's a link on my website. If people go to my website, there's a link to that poem. And I think it's because it's funny. It's like a funny, you know, but it's also political. It's also, it has Santa Claus dying in an apartment. You know, it has crazy things in there. But it's a commentary on people being homeless or whatever, you know.
Alan, we have a lot of listeners to this show that are writers themselves. What is either the best or the worst piece of writing advice you have to give?
Oh, wow. I haven't had this question. The best or the worst? Oh, it's so hard. So remind me of this question. This is what happens to me. I think we're all so different. I was just listening to one of your podcasts with Helen Gardner, and she said she writes every day. And I was like, oh my gosh, I need to write every day. Oh no, I'm not writing every day. Because you hear people say things, and then if you're my kind of person, you're like, oh my gosh, I need to work out every day. I need to play basketball every day. You get obsessive. And I realized for me, it doesn't work like that. I write in these huge sprints where I write 10 to 13 hours a day. I don't stop. I can't see, which isn't great for my personal life. But that's how I do it. And then I take a break. I go to Australia. I try to sell the book. And so a grain of salt, I guess, for whatever I say next, I guess a grain of salt for people. But I guess the very basic thing, which is not going to be rocket science, and this is what my professor said to me, and I think it's even in the book, I steal everything, is just to put your butt in the chair. That you know, if you want to be a writer, or if you are, you know, Well, one thing is to say you're a writer. That's a long time ago now, but I remember trying to just say I'm a writer. But just writing and not trying. Yeah, here it is. Here it is. This is a good one. Not trying to finish a product, not trying to make it perfect, just putting words together and being happy with that. Even if it's like three sentences, even if it's 5 minutes, because if you get obsessed with creating a perfect story or a perfect poem, that creates writer's block. And I think that's one reason I started doing games, was it was a way to write without caring about the product, because I was just playing. So yeah. So worst piece of advice, write every day, even though it's very good advice and everyone should do it, but it's scary. And then the best would be to make it fun. Figure out whatever it is to make it fun so that the process itself is something you enjoy, which isn't mind-blowing. Nice. Yeah, it's not mind-blowing, but it does work for me, I guess.
We are on our final question. Alan, can you recommend a debut book by any author from any place, any era?
Yeah, so yep. I would recommend, so when I came here, I met some who turned out to be famous Australian writers. I didn't know that in the beginning, and they were so nice to me. I was like, how are you famous? You're so nice. But I guess those things can go together. But I met Mirandi Ruo and Laura Jean McKay, and I love both the books that I read. Mirandi's was not a debut, but I guess Laura Jean McKay's was The Animals in That Country, I believe it's called. And I read that as we drove across the outback for 3 days from Adelaide to Brisbane, and I had not seen a kangaroo yet. And after 100 pages, I was just tearing through that book. I was like, I'm super excited and also super afraid to meet a kangaroo, because I'm pretty sure they're going to speak to me in experimental poetry. And the genius of that book is that she took something I love, experimental poetry, and she put it into like a best, you know, like a page turner. I was like, oh my gosh, how did you do this? Yeah, people are reading experimental poetry out of animals' mouths and they're turning the pages. That's a feat right there.
Yeah. What a wonderful experience of reading that book too.
Yeah. It's intense. Yeah. It gets, you know, it's grueling in some ways, but it's because it just goes and goes and goes. But I did tear through it in the back of a car driving across the outback.
Oh, a fabulous recommendation. Thank you for today, for your insight and advice, Alan, for being on the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much. This is great.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.